Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're debating the merits of a band we rarely ever talk about, Kiss. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. Plus, we'll pay tribute to the late great drummer Sam Lay, but first, a review of the debut studio album by Amber Mark.
It is very rare, but baby, it does exist. And when you find it up, you realize it comes within. That's what gives a...
That is a little bit of the track Most Men from Amber Mark's first full studio album, Three Dimensions Deep. Fascinating artist, Greg, born in Tennessee to a Jamaican dad and a German mother, wound up another one of those. It seems like we've been talking about this a lot with songwriters. World travelers,
yeah, right.
As a kid, right? Spends time in Germany, spends time in Miami and New York, and then India, where her mom goes to study at a monastery. Amber Mark winds up based in New York and begins by releasing several singles and floating tracks on the net and an EP inspired by the death of her mother. We've been waiting 3 years for an actual album from Ms. Mark, and now here it is, a sort of cosmic contemplation on love, Three Dimensions Deep. Let's play a track, and then we'll give our opinions on this album. This is a song called What It Is by Amber Mark on Sound Opinions.
That's What It Is from Amber Mark's debut album, Three Dimensions Deep. As you mentioned, Jim, long in the making. A lot of people have been anticipating a record from Amber Mark. She's got a lot of accolades for those two EPs. Since the last EP, she's been experimenting, doing cover versions of songs by Nirvana, Cisco,
yeah.
Kind of opening up her songwriting portals, so to speak. It's sort of an attempt to sort of loosen up her style. She felt that she was being almost like self-restricting herself in her earlier songwriting and wanted to loosen up a bit. So what does she come back with? A three-part concept album as their debut album, with all, as you mentioned, this sort of a cosmic imagery sprinkled throughout.
I was waiting. I was waiting for your snide chuckle because I know you're anti astrology.
Well, I'm not. I'm not big on astrology, and I guess you could. You know, the Afrofuturist vibe. You know, I'm interested in that. Obviously,
that.
That's incredible. But, you know, some of the metaphors are a bit strained here. You know, a lot of people are pointing to the song Dark Side. You know, it is just sprinkled with howlers. But then the force is strong when I'm skywalking by your solar system.
The force is strong when I'm skywalking by your solar system.
It's easy to focus on the stuff that you think isn't so good because most of this album is actually very ambitious and well executed. Amber is not only a songwriter, but produces more than half the tracks or engineers them. So she's very involved in the way this record sounds, and she's experimenting with everything from soulful R&B, pop funk. You know, Dark Side maybe lyrically isn't that great, but you know, it's a nice Prince homage as well.
Nice,
you know,
Prince riff, yes.
And you know, that little bit of house and FOMO, retro funk and foreign things. I mean, she's one of the tracks that really captured me was On and On, the way she's contrasting those big drums with that beautiful string orchestration on that track, and then layering the wordless vocals throughout. So she's masterful at the way she's using her voice, layering her voice, experimenting with these different styles. You know, with that middle cosmology section, she sort of loses me a little bit. But she's basically, you know, talking about, this is a record about, self-improvement. And at the end, she comes out looking a little brighter about the whole world, going through these romantic travails, little sidestep with the cosmic stuff. But overall, I think this is a very promising debut album from this artist.
Well, you know, I'm the one who wrote a book about psychedelic rock. So to see romantic love in terms of universal cosmology, okay, I can put up with a little of that. There are only a few missteps here, Greg. Bubbles, I think, where she does this kind of dance hall thing. But this is an album that is designed to be a mainstream pop album, but with these subversive touches. That track that we played, What It Is, the last 30 seconds erupting into this Eddie Hazel funkadelic, you know, guitar, solo, man, psychedelic funk. You know, there's times where she's dropping in these analog synth squibbles that could would not sound out of place on a Can record. You know, she has a great ear, and she's working with a couple of really good producers, folks who've worked with The Weeknd, but she's clearly the master of her own sonic stew. And if you are listening in the background while you're doing the dishes, cooking dinner, the first two times I listened, you would say, this is a good pop record, strong voice, a little too long, 17 songs, and a little hippy-dippy at points, but the closer you listen, it does reward you. And I go back to our ace producer, Alex Claiborne, did a Hooked on Sonics with Amber. She chose a Michael Jackson track from Off the Wall.
Okay.
Now, you know, Michael Jackson.
Well
before she was born. But, of course, that is the masterpiece, not Thriller.
Right.
You know, she chose well. And as Jackson was a pop omnivore, Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Before listening to everything that he basically brought into dance pop, that's what Amber is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I think this is a brilliant pop album, and I think it's emblematic. A lot of the pop records we've been reviewing in the last year and a half have sort of been so eclectic and so genre-less,
yeah.
You know, in the way they approach. And it's an exciting development in the way pop music is being crafted these days. You know, Jim and I both kind of dig that Amber Mark record. So
yeah.
Now we want to hear from you. Let us know on our Facebook group or in our Patreon community what you thought. And leave a voice message on our website as well, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Coming up, we ponder at the age-old question. Is Kiss any good? That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. This week, we're begrudgingly putting on the platform boots and breathing fire to discuss a band we, I think we swore, Greg, silently, but it was understood that we would never talk about Kiss.
Yeah, Kiss-free
zone. On
Sound
Opinions.
Yeah.
But something happened. A friend of the show wrote a really good piece.
He did indeed. Joining us to talk about the band is author, professor, and friend Sam Weller. We had Sam on the show last fall where we chatted about what makes a great spooky ghost song and his work as Ray Bradbury's official biographer. And now we have him back to talk about Kiss. Let's jump into that conversation.
All right. So Sam spent the summer, the entire summer, like way too many hours that I even want to think about, writing this epic. It's got to be like 30,000 words. A Kiss Army loyalist on how Kiss transformed his life and how the band should end it all. So Sam is a Kiss super fan. And I got this wrong. I thought I was younger than you, but you're 3 years younger than me. And Greg Kot and I have talked about Kiss in the past in the form of one sentence dismissively and said we were just the wrong age. It didn't grab us. Certainly, you didn't change our minds, but we thought we've gone, like 850 episodes of Sound Opinions. We've never had a discussion with Kiss. Lord knows we wouldn't want to talk to them, but to try to explain the phenomenon of Kiss, we thought we'd have you back, Professor Sam, to educate us on Kiss.
Oh, where does one begin, even attempting to explain the phenomenon of Kiss?
Well, you began, I think you began in the only way that Kiss should be written about, which was as part memoir. About
yeah.
growing up
yeah.
and discovering this band at the tender age of 8 or 9,
mm-hmm.
right, in Minnesota. So start with how you became a fan and why, even as a professor of literature
right.
and as a music lover, you're not ashamed to still admit that there are Kiss things you like.
Yeah, Kiss Alive came out September 10th, 1975, I believe.
He knows the date.
You know? Yeah, you never forget the date. You know, your girlfriend's day, you know,
yeah, yeah.
birthday, and you know,
when Kiss Alive,
when
came,
Kiss
out.
Alive came out.
I moved to Minnesota in 1976 from California, so I grew up on a diet of the Beach Boys.
Mm.
You know, so I grew up really loving pop music and harmony and Minnesota was paramount in that shift. In that, I was in, I'll never forget the day in my fourth grade classroom when a bunch of kids were gathered in the back by a table looking at something. And I had no friends. I had long blonde California hair and I didn't know anybody. And I walked back and I'm, what are you all looking at?
Mm-hmm.
And they're all looking at this gatefold double live album, you know, with handwritten letters by each band member. I mean, there's a monkey's aspect to it. There's a super heroic aspect
yeah.
to it that the kids were just salivating over. And I'd never heard of them. I'd never heard anything by them.
Mm.
And my curiosity was piqued, but not piqued enough to listen to it yet. At some point I told my brother, who's 4 years older than me and missed the Kiss window. I think you're absolutely correct.
There's
and I think,
to be, yeah, you gotta have you to know, be a certain age.
I think there's a certain age that we gravitate towards a certain cadre of cartoons as well. And so I was in that Kiss window and my older brother wasn't. But he has always been very into music and knowledgeable. And I said, Do you know about Kiss? He said, sure. I said, what album should I get? And he said, Kiss Destroyer. It just came out. Mm. So I went and picked that up at the Ridgedale Mall in Wayzata, Minnesota, and was perplexed initially by the armada of guitars in Detroit Rock City.
Yeah.
It was not the Beach Boys. But I think the cover of that album is straight torn out of comic books. Mm-hmm. They're super heroic. They're spandex clad, makeup clad, superheroes. The next album I bought was Kiss Alive, which I will maintain, and I will go to the mat for the brilliance of that album. And I think many people would argue that Kiss Alive is one of the preeminent live record albums ever made. Now, of course, we can say it's not completely live.
Well, no.
But what is? Neither is
not,
Peter Frampton.
Not even close to completely live.
I know. There's a lot of touch-up. But their argument is you spit blood, you breathe fire, you run around, you play guitar in a confetti storm and not have to do studio over.
But that is a slippery slope, Sam. Yeah.
I hear your argument there, but I think what had eluded Kiss previously on their first three studio albums prior to releasing Kiss Alive was capturing their live energy. And Kiss Alive, whether it's replete with studio overdubbing and Eddie Kramer production magician work, it captures Kiss live because they went into the studio probably and recorded a lot of it, as you're saying, but they played it like they played it on stage. So the solos are elongated and there's a much more elevated energy to that album. You know, that's the album that I would give any, you know, in their entire catalog, that's the album I would hand anybody to try to convert them.
So here's the thing, and I hear you. I hear you on those the connection there, because I was just a touch too old to be moved by it. And I, like, we sneered at the kid, you know, the little guy who bought the Kiss record. Oh, that's for little kids. You know, I'm a sophisticated teenager by this point, or whatever, or thought I was. And that the point being, all right, these are dumb songs. They're just dumb. Looking back in hindsight, they're, in some ways they have these rousing anthemic qualities, and you recognize why people would have gravitated toward that. But here's the thing. I've interviewed Simmons before. I've interviewed Paul Stanley. Those guys are smart guys. They're way smarter than they write, you know?
I completely agree.
And what's the deal? I mean, Simmons always sneered at the idea of art.
Yeah.
In so many words, saying it's about selling an image. A brand, you know, the brand as band is, I think you put it in your
essay. I completely disagree with him on that, but it's his band. Yeah. And I've also interviewed him in the past, too. Yeah. And he said, it's my band, not yours. Get your own band, is what he told me. You know? I'm like, yeah, but I told him about the vinyl I bought at Ridgedale Mall, and I helped buy his Beverly Hills mansion. So I have a right to my opinion.
You have a right, yeah.
But, I agree with you that I think, their previous musical incarnation prior to Kiss was a band called Wicked Lester, which was flutes and five-part harmony and much more an affectation of late 60s, early 70s pop and psychedelia. And I think it bored them. I think you're right. I think they wanted to keep it simple, stupid. Kiss, I would tell you that, I mean, Jim and I have talked about this in the past. There's no doubt offensive lyrics in some of the songs, massive stupidity. A line like, you're such a jewel in the rough, I want to show you my stuff. I mean, who writes that? And Gene Simmons was an English teacher in Spanish Harlem in New York City.
From Israel.
Yeah. He's multilingual. I mean, these are not unintelligent people.
Exactly.
But I gravitate towards Kiss, one, for the showmanship, two, for the mystique. You'd never saw saw their faces without makeup ever when you were, when I was a kid. Three, for the rousing anthemic songs you speak of. I mean, there's an empowerment that they give to a young listener when you're a little kid and you're like, I want to put my fist in the air too. You're damn right.
Yeah.
I never gravitated nor understood, put your hand in my pocket, grab onto my rocket, Spinetapian BS.
Sam Weller, English professor at Columbia College, Chicago.
And now I look at it, and there's this oxymoronic quality to KISS that there's a wink and a nudge sort of troglodyte cheese fest to them that is completely understandable.
So many questions. All right. We had Bob Ezrin on. We had a fantastic conversation with Bob Ezrin.
Smart guy.
Incredible resume as a producer. I don't think either of us, we didn't even think of asking him about Destroyer, Greg.
That's true. Wasn't high on our list of priorities that day.
I will grant you this. There is a certain production, that album in particular.
Yeah.
If I had to, at gunpoint, listen to one, at love gun point, to listen to one KISS album, it would be that one.
Sure.
But I wouldn't last long.
Well, and it's interesting. If I had the privileged position the two of you had, and I was sitting down with Bob Ezrin, I wouldn't ask him about Destroyer. I would ask him about KISS's oft-maligned and much-hated 1981 concept album, Music from the Elder, which he also produced, which is probably my favorite KISS album.
Wow.
I mean, it's kind of...
Oh, no, wait a minute.
In KISS this, attempting to do Rush.
In this 30,000-word epic for Pop Matters, you say... KISS jumped the shark in 78.
Oh, they did, but there's been merit since. I mean, they did jump the shark, and I love the eras where they jumped the shark. Oh, I have watched the 1978 film, KISS Meets the Phantom of the Park, with my children. It's produced by Hanna-Barbera. It's terrible. It's horrible. Paul and Gene can't even discuss it. They're so embarrassed by it.
See, I admire nothing. Greg and I admire nothing more than... a pleasure that you should be guilty about that you nevertheless wholeheartedly endorse. I mean, how many times, Greg? Smash Mouth. I always like Smash Mouth. I like the Black Eyed Peas.
Black Eyed Peas, right. Well, here's the thing. Ezrin being involved with the band, and it seemed like they had the hit.
Yeah.
The biggest hit of their career with Ezrin.
Number seven. Yep.
So that to me is an interesting trial by fire for the hardcore young KISS fan who's into these rocking songs, and then they come out with this kind of cheesy ballad, Beth, sung by the drummer Peter Criss, right?
Yeah.
And like, whoa, is that, that's KISS?
Just a few more hours and I'll be right home to you. I think I hear them calling. Oh, Beth, what can I do?
As I said in my Pop Matters essay, I think that Destroyer initially perplexed the Camaro driving, bong hitting beer crowd from Detroit, Rock City.
We all can.
I mean, after the show, that's what we're all doing, right? We're hopping in my Camaro.
A part of my life was Dazed and Confused. Richard Linklater, it's immortal.
Yeah.
When The Replacements cover KISS, when Nirvana covers KISS, when Tom Morello from Libertyville, Illinois, and Rage Against the Machine inducts them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, there's something you got to stop and say.
There's something so wrong about a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist like Morello, inducting the most capitalist rock band of all time.
He's also friends with Ted Nugent, so how do we figure any of this out?
Yeah. It is complicated.
Who is of the same era?
The psyche of our...
What about Beth? What about it, though? What? How did you respond to that? Like, oh wow, that's amazing.
I think I'm an odd KISS fan in that anything they handed me on a platter, I sort of just took because I wasn't discerning enough as a music fan to critically analyze it. And I thought, as a creator myself, and my whole life I've been creative, I have always admired artists who do new things. And so if KISS is just going to be three-chord, anthemic, dumbed-down, misogynistic songcraft, they're never going to grow, and it's going to get tiresome. And so I think my initial response at 8 or 9 years old, whatever I was, to Beth was... okay, this is a departure. I've always liked departures from artists. I like when, you know, it's the old Bowie quote, if you're in your comfort zone, you're not creating. Yeah. I'm paraphrasing poorly.
But yeah.
Sam is a brave man articulating his love for Kiss so well. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Sam about Kiss, and later we'll pay tribute to the late Sam Lay. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. This week, we're talking all things Kiss with author and friend of the show, Sam Weller. Let's get back to the conversation.
Let's tackle the misogyny, Sam. You use the word.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating that I am aware of 4 all-female Kiss cover bands.
Wow, even I did not know that, Jim. So
you don't know any?
Well, no, I know.
Two of them are in Chicago.
Yeah, no, I knew of a couple, but I didn't know there were 4 of them.
This is a thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is interesting that some women are reclaiming the power that is Kiss. Maybe that's what they're... I don't know. Maybe they just were the same age reading comic books like you. I don't know. But how do you now, as an educator, you know, you and I have been in how many diversity, equity, and inclusion seminars?
It's true.
It is indefensible.
Yeah, and I'm also the father of 3 daughters, you know, and so you listen to these lyrics, and I actually asked Gene Simmons that question myself, and he said, well, I said, how do you reconcile your tabulation of groupie conquests with the fact that you have a daughter yourself? And he said, well, I would never parent like that. And so that's kind of a crazy response. It's like he's maligning the parent for letting their girls out of
the house.
Yeah. And so, you know, there are songs in the Kiss catalog that I honestly do not like because of the lyrics. Mm. I mean, there's some songs that I don't think they could ever play live again. A song like, well, we're not going to keep parsing lyrics. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, that's, you know, borderline hashtag Me Too issues going on with the lyrical content.
You know,
of
but
this.
We could, and it's probably a little bit unfair of us to just, you know, malign Kiss for that because just about every 70s hard
Aerosmith.
Rock band.
Well, even I mean, Queen. mean.
Misogynist.
No, Rolling Stones, a band Greg and I love. Right. Even the New York Dolls, and I thought it was some very interesting rock critic juxtaposition there in your essay. It was a fine line between the Dolls and Kiss.
Yeah.
They were on bills together. They were on magazine covers together. I would say the Dolls were far more revolutionary. With their gender bending and with David Johansen's deep knowledge of rock history, they weren't quite as silly as Kiss.
No, but
Kiss was a cartoon.
Right. But I think you could say, I think it's undeniable that Kiss was revolutionary in their level of entertainment and performance.
Showmanship?
Yeah, the showmanship. Theatricality.
Yeah. Alice Cooper was doing it.
They created this amazing spectacle. And yeah, Alice Cooper probably got there first, but they probably took it to the 10th degree. So I get that point. The other thing that is hard for me to stomach about Kiss is the relentless marketing. If there was ever a turning point in like when you realize it was Rock Inc. and not rock and roll anymore, it was like the Kiss formula. Like, we're going to market that. We're going to make lunchboxes. We're going to make, you know.
Oh, Sam points out caskets.
Yeah.
You can buy a Kiss casket and you can buy Kiss birth control.
Yeah. Oh, everything under the sun, right, has got a Kiss logo on it, right? So there was that sort of crass business approach to it. And again, Simmons would laugh at me when I would ask him questions about that. Like, what's your, what makes you so high and mighty, so pure? You know, there's nothing pure about rock and roll. It's a mongrel art form. You know, he's going on and on about that whole thing. And you can do whatever you want. So how did you, as a, sophisticated college professor now, are you going to endorse that and say that's cool? I get behind that,
I collect very little by way of Kiss memorabilia. I do have a Kiss trash can in my Columbia College office, but it's kind of a fitting metaphor for our conversation here, the way you're all approaching
trash aesthetic.
I don't collect all of that stuff, and I completely, again, vehemently disagree with the aforementioned demon of Kiss, Gene Simmons, that this whole mantra of they're a brand, not a band, is just utter BS to me. I wanted the vinyl, and I wanted to listen to the albums, and if I could go see them live, which I did in first time in 1979 with the original four members, I loved just the feeling of the empowerment of the rock and the Gibson Les Pauls and the Marshalls. I didn't care about so much the puzzles and the action figures, although I had those too because I was 10 years older than right. But I think it's a disservice, actually. I know this sounds absurd, the artistic legacy of Kiss. That sounds completely oxymoronic. But to continue to hammer home this we're a brand, not a band mantra, I think two of the original members partially went off the rails because they couldn't deal with that. Mm-hmm. Ace Frehley, who was my favorite member of Kiss, I think. The Spaceman. I mean, his guitar playing is reflective of, a sloppy, dirty Jimmy Page and some Chuck Berry noodling, but it's good.
His solo album is excellent. I will say that.
I think he disagreed completely. And I think the drug usage of Peter Criss and Ace Frehley came into play because of the sort of, as they splintered off and became this marketing enterprise.
Yeah.
But when you're four guys wearing kabuki makeup and comic book costumes, you can see how their manager saw opportunity and money. Everybody says she's looking good.
Frehley and Criss, 2021 documentary, Kiss Story, K-I-S-S Tory, right? Louis and Tony in my band also share my disdain for Kiss, but they were drunk, and so they watched this last weekend. And, they thought the funniest part of it was, there's an afterword, a Chiron, Ace Frehley and Peter Criss disagree with everything in this documentary and had nothing to say.
I think some of the hilarity is those guys just can't make peace with each other. And it's so freaking sad. It was four dudes from New York City who came together in a loft on, I think, the fourth floor of 10 East 23rd. I went up there 3 years ago before the pandemic and went there myself. Snuck into the building.
It's in the story.
Yeah.
A guy working in a building.
Let me in. Inside. He let me in. And the fact that, you know, to me, to a Kiss fan, that's the Liverpool. That's the Cavern Club. Mm-hmm. To a Kiss fan. I'm sorry. I know that's like blasphemy to you guys. Rush loves Kiss. Brian May loves Kiss. I mean, you know, there's lots of people who love Kiss. So that documentary, you know, I don't know whether you watched it, Greg, or not. Probably not, right?
No, I didn't miss that one.
You know, I think that Gene and Paul were as honest as they've ever been in that documentary. They were actually, there was a little bit of, God forbid, there was some humility in those in them. Wow. So that came through.
Because they're 70-something.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, the same as I saw with Ray Bradbury, there's a recognition of the last chapters of life, and you become a become a bit more humble.
No, exactly. I mean, our friend Jan Uhelski did this extensive interview with both Stanley and Simmons for the Cream documentary, and I saw the outtakes. They only were able to use... You know, Paul Stanley comes across as a very, you know, introspective, smart guy. Simmons is more full of himself, and he, you know, offering opinions about stuff that he has no business, you know, opining about. But the point being, there was some, you know, clearly some intelligence there.
You know, before you get off Jan, there also was a period where they laughed at themselves. You know,
That's what I'm going to get.
He's famous for, you know, I dreamed I was in Kiss in my maiden form bra.
And that's
they
a great...
let her dress up as a member of Kiss.
And that's a great piece. They had fun with it, and they were having fun doing this. And at the same time, Gene especially had this sort of business sense. Like when you think about something like Black Sabbath, you know, those guys had zero business sense. They were just happy to get out of a factory job in England, you know?
Yeah.
And then they finally found a manager who was going to, like, freaking, you know, figure out how to make this pay off so that you guys can have a living doing this. I mean, Gene and Paul were like that, you know, they had a vision for what this could be and how much money they could make. And at a certain point, you realize the band brand thing, that's real. These guys were kind of like ahead of their time in that they did turn it into a business almost instantly, you know?
Yeah.
And that's either really smart or that's just really like,
insidious.
Ew. You know, it's
but
like.
But I also think that, you know, as I said in my essay, it's only 11,000 words, by the
11,
way. 30,000.
All right. It's epic.
I mean,
epic was the key.
The Great
word.
Gatsby is 53,000 words. I'm just like that.
All right. Is that right?
Yeah.
God, that's a revelation.
Wow. No, Fahrenheit 451, 50,000 words. It's not 30,000 words.
Wow. All right. Okay.
But,
sorry.
You know, they have their bona fides in early rock and roll. They toured in a station wagon for 3 years with their road crew.
Yeah.
Hard scrabble, you know, wearing sweaty leather bat costumes and space costumes, you know, uncleaned for weeks. They paid their rock dues.
I think that comes through in every story I've read about Kiss is that it took a while for them to connect. You know, and figure out what they wanted to do, how they wanted to present themselves, and more power to them. But there's a lot of bands who do that and then continue to make music that's, you know, packed with integrity and gets better. What they do. Like, we can do something with this as an art form. And Kiss never sort of aspired to that, which is, okay, it is just a freaking, it might as well be McDonald's, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. But I think what's also fascinating about Kiss is that every era, there's something that Kiss fans can find to latch on to and argue about and have an opinion on. Mm-hmm. There's so many different chapters to that band's legacy. The makeup, the no makeup, the different members.
That's kind of fascinating. Are there fans who came on board in the no makeup era?
Oh, yeah. There's fans who prefer the 80s, which is not my... Although I would also argue there's some merit to be found. One could argue that their last album with makeup, Creatures of the Night, is a thunderous hard rock album. It's their return, probably, arguably, their hardest album. We're creatures of the night. And the drum production, it's the second album with their second drummer, Eric Carr, who was the Fox. That was his persona. And he was a Brooklyn oven repairman who they wanted an unknown because of the makeup and the mystique. Yeah. And they hired him.
They no doubt paid him less.
I think they probably paid him, but they gave him a Porsche upon signing the contract. Mm. So he was in. He
Cadillac
was a
Records.
Thunderous.
It's like Leonard Chess paying off Muddy Waters. Cadillac
Records, the royalty check?
Yeah.
Or do you want this Cadillac car?
Behind the car, we're not going to pay you.
Right. That's a thunderous album. So that's the beginning. That's the last makeup album of the 80s. Absolutely great record.
Yeah, but they, you know, you see those pictures of them on MTV without makeup.
Yes.
There is no sadder picture in rock history. That is a sorry-looking group of middle-aged
Well, and then they flip back to the makeup, because I thought, you know, my impression of that era, Sam, was that they thought it was a bust. Like, they made this move, shake up the formula,
We got to do something new.
And we got to do something new, and the fans didn't like it.
I don't think that's true. I think their second highest charting song came out on an album called Hot in the Shade in the late 80s called Forever. And it's a power ballad, and it's straight from the pages of Bon Jovi and Poison and hair metal power ballads.
Right.
It was a digression into hair metal. I think Gene Simmons has said very vocally that he really struggled with his image during that era.
Yeah.
It is cringy to look at certain tour pictures, no doubt. And I was thrilled when they reunited.
Yeah. And put on the makeup.
And put the makeup and costumes back on. But, you know, the 80s, there are, as you said, there are fans who just favor that era.
I didn't say that. I asked it, and you said yes, and I'm still shocked by that.
They're still filling the stadiums with something.
So Sam, at the end of this not quite 30,000 word, merely 12,000 word essay, you offer, there is plenty of criticism in your piece, and we've been having fun with you because Greg and I, who else are we going to argue with Kiss about, right? Tom Morello, I guess. Yeah, I'd rather talk to him about why he was wrong about the Red Hand Maoist movement, which I have. You suggest three possible ends for this band.
Yes, they listened to none of them.
And they listened to none. They didn't listen to their number one fan. You wanted to see them go out literally in a blaze of glory with one final show with the makeup, yeah?
I think that's still possible. You know, prior to COVID, they had scheduled a show at a venue to be named later in New York City. Mm. There was lots of conjecture. And back to their roots, full circle. Mm-hmm. There's a very vocal fan community online where people are all offering their opinions. Kiss fans are the most opinionated bunch of rock fans. I mean, it's insane.
We may be asking for trouble here. Greg.
Yeah.
It's whenever we talk about Rush, which is always complimentary, and yet it's never complimentary enough.
Oh, right. But no, I understand that, and I'm totally willing to take the heat.
Yeah. You know? We are. So which iteration did you want to see with one final New York show and makeup?
I think the best case scenario, but it's impossible, is if we're going to go full circle, you've got to have the two original members back in some capacity for that last show.
Yeah.
They've got to come out and at least play three songs together. But from all appearances, original drummer Peter Criss is retired and hates them. Yeah. They hate him. They all say they're a family and they bicker and they love each other. But Ace seems to be kind of begging to be back. Mm. He's now opening for Alice Cooper, go figure, on the road presently. But to me, they need to conclude as they began.
When Ace was too drugged out to play sometimes, they tapped Cooper veteran Steve Hunter, or was it Wagner or Hunter?
Dick Wagner.
Dick Wagner.
He played a solo on
From
Destroyer.
The Cooper album and Rock and Roll Animal by Lou Reed.
Right, exactly. Because Ezrin had produced both of them, obviously.
The Ezrin connection.
So I think in some incarnation, the original band should close the final curtain. They have an opportunity to do what few bands do. If this is legitimately their last show, which does anybody really believe given the brand
Nobody
and marketing?
Retires.
But they really could go out if they just said, this is truly it. I mean, Gene Simmons does make an argument that he's 71 years old, wearing 40 pounds of armor, breathing fire. How much longer can the guy physically do that?
Yeah, right. It's crazy.
And so they can go out like no band, get the four original members at least to play the encore together.
And get one of the female Kiss cover bands to open. Right? Now that would be, you know.
Love it.
You know, really, anybody with the makeup could be Kiss.
I think they're talking about a Kiss 2.0 now. I mean, they've brought that up. That, you know, there will be a reality show where they themselves pick their replacements.
All right.
So,
well, we finally have figured it out. I think Sam Weller has an end game for Kiss.
That,
a pretty very logical conclusion to his storied love affair with this band. The only way to end it. Like, you're breaking up with them in some ways, but you're... There's one final date, right, in your future.
You don't have a Kiss casket, do you?
I will never succumb to that. There's just no way.
They at the end of the show, they could each get into one of the Kiss caskets.
I like it. And the lids close.
Yeah.
The caskets could lower on
hydraulic.
Fade
to black. And then Kiss 2.0.
And then the flames go
up. The winners
up,
of the reality show come out, and they play the rest of the set.
You know, I know they didn't like the piece I wrote for Pop Matters because I wrote it. And generally, if there's a piece of any piece of media that is even remotely pro-Kiss, they share it on their own social media accounts.
Wow.
And the fans, interestingly enough, understood what I was trying to say because it was, while I was critical and made fun of them, I also was celebratory of them. Only 100% positivity from fans, but never any sort
them.
Of sharing from them, which is unusual.
All right. Well, we can't let you go without one bigger philosophical question. All right. So I have long maintained as a critic, and I think Greg agrees with much of this, you know, nostalgia is the kiss of death. And I think any piece of criticism that begins with you really had to be there, whether it's Louding, Woodstock, I've seen the movie. Mm-hmm. I've been to raves in the mud in Wisconsin that were way better musically. Aphex Twin playing, Daft Punk playing, right? Better than Richie Havens, okay? Anything that begins, you really had to be there. Is it an inescapable fact, you know, that this hit you at 8, 9, you had to be there, you were there.
You know, I know exactly where you're going with this question because the first time you and I really talked about Kiss in depth was in the hallway where we both teach as professors at Columbia College. And you said, this is a nostalgia thing. It's going back to your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You were psychoanalyzing me in the hallway at Columbia College. And certainly, I think we all, as Ray Bradbury, and everything connects in my life to Ray Bradbury,
yes,
would say we all have a root system.
It's your
that
brain.
That root system,
you know,
is our is our childhood.
Yeah.
That's where our root system begins, and our aesthetic begins when we're children, and it expands and grows and blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly I like much more music than just, you know, Kiss.
Yes,
thank goodness.
Yes.
But I think there's a nostalgia element. But, you know, I brought that nostalgia full circle as well. I brought my three daughters to see Kiss in 2019, and that's the last time I'll ever see them. They're coming back to Chicago, the never-ending end of the road tour.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go. I brought my three kids, and that's it.
And what did they think?
You know, it's interesting. They loved the spectacle of it. I think I bought them noise-reducing headphones. It was loud. It was cacophonous. And I think it was probably too long for them. Mm. There were some long-winded, you know, early Kiss songs have some long-winded guitar soloing. I think that was... But any time someone was flying somewhere, a flash pot was exploding. Gene's coming out by them on a hydraulic lift.
Yeah.
They're loving it, you know?
Man. Yeah, well, you know, NSYNC flew in when I saw them, too.
But they wouldn't have flown in if it weren't for Kiss.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Sam Weller, for having the courage to talk about Kiss. All in good fun there. And all hate mail should be directed only to me and Greg Codd, not Sam Weller.
Please, no. Thanks, guys.
That wraps up our discussion on Kiss, and now we want to hear from you. Are you a Kiss super fan, or are you allergic to the band completely, or are you somewhere in between? Share your thoughts with us via message on our website, soundopinions.org. Now, Jim, we want to pivot to talking about one of the great drummers.
Man, listen to that man in action, Greg. Sam Lay.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. Sam Lay, one of the great drummers of all time. Probably not a household name, but he should be. He died January 29th at age 86. You know, when I first became fully aware of how impactful Sam Lay was and is, you know, I interviewed Iggy Pop. And he told me about the days that he came down to Chicago to, you know, firsthand witness these blues giants performing. And they indulged him.
When he was still Jimmy Osterberg from Michigan.
Jimmy Osterberg from Michigan comes down a teenager. He's forming his own, you know, blues-based band. He wants to learn from the masters.
And he's a drummer.
And he hangs out and he goes, of all the giants that he met, you know, Muddy, Howlin' Wolf, you know, he saw them all. He said, Sam Lay was the guy.
Yeah,
I was really enamored with the way Sam carried himself, the way he dressed, the way he talked to me. You know, it was incredibly influential in the way he developed his sound and his approach to music.
The way he dressed, right, with a walking stick and a cape, right?
Yeah,
is that what the...
Sam came prepared. I mean, he was dressed to the nines. You know, he could be playing a funky club on the south side or the west side, and he would still look like, you know, a guy who just walked out of GQ or something that, right?
Love it.
Yeah, he was an incredibly stylish man and an incredibly stylish drummer. I know you appreciate him because he was not one of those guys who put like a thumbprint on every song, like, oh, that's the Sam Lay drum sound. But those shuffles that he played were integral to so many blues records. Born in Alabama, came to Chicago in the 50s, started out with Little Walter. That's not bad. Muddy Waters hires him in 1960. Muddy Waters could have worked with any drummer in Chicago. He could have snapped his fingers, I want you. He picks Sam Lay as the guy he wants to work with. And Sam was in Muddy's band for the next 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then returned to work with Muddy on one of the best-selling Muddy Waters record anyway, on Chess Records, Fathers and Sons in 1969. That was his post. Remember the Electric Mud record?
Right.
This was the follow-up back to sort of more of a traditional
back
style
to Muddy's
for
roots.
Muddy.
Yeah.
One of these days, I'm gonna show you how nice a man can be.
And in fact, you know, if you listen to the Fathers and Sons records, you see him presaging what he would do with Johnny Winter in the 70s for the final big comeback of Muddy's career. But Sam was that kind of guy. He played with everybody. Willie Dixon, Howlin' Wolf, Eddie Taylor, John Lee Hooker, Junior Wells, Bo Diddley, Magic Sam, Jimmy Rogers, Earl Hooker. You know, 40-plus albums, recordings with Chess alone. Paul Butterfield.
The first Butterfield album.
Exactly. Here's this guy coming down to pick a drummer, and Sam Lay is the guy that worked with him. Think about Sam as being kind of a bridge between that blues sound in Chicago and rock.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the influence he had on Iggy and the way he thought about the Stooges, for example, when you think about the Paul Butterfield thing.
Listen to those rhythms on that first Stooges album. And it all came from church, Greg. Why I said Gospel Sam is that double time clapping.
Right, right.
Right? You know, the shuffle. Everybody called it a shuffle, right?
Right.
That's lazy, but it's more than that. It's like a skip beat. It's it has a lot to do with Bo Diddley as well. It was beautiful.
Yeah, you break down the hand clapping on those gospel records. That's Sam Lay's
style,
right?
When the whole church is getting into it.
And let's face it, you know, historic. Talk about a Zelig-like career. You know, working with Muddy, working with Little Walter, working with Howlin' Wolf.
Yep.
You know, Paul Butterfield. You know, Paul Butterfield's on the cover of Time magazine, right?
Yeah.
This is how important this band was viewed as sort of this biracial blues rock band in Chicago in the mid-60s. Here's Dylan going electric. Who's the drummer at Newport when the world was raging? Like, what is Dylan doing, you know? Sam Lay.
How did that happen?
You know, the fact that he Bloomfield was working with Dylan
Bloomfield
very closely on the Highway 61 Revisited record.
Right.
In fact, Sam played drums on the title track of Highway 61.
Okay.
And so it was a natural fit for Bloomfield to bring in his pal Sam to play drums in this historic moment in, yep. In music history. I mean, there's pre-Newport Dylan and there's post-Newport Dylan. And you can divide rock history in that way. Sam was there at that moment being that drummer. Again, I think that speaks to his whole career, bridging those genres, being able to do that as a drummer. And then, you know, finishing out his career in recent years, he's been playing with the Siegel Schwall Band, a revered Chicago blues band that Sam continued to work in. So ever since the 50s, basically, Sam has been continuously working for somebody, playing in somebody's blues band.
Well, 86, A Good Life, Sam lay shuffling into the beyond. What do we have on the show next week, Greg?
Next week, Jim, we have a fascinating discussion about an artist that we have been talking about for a number of years, decades, in fact, with some of our friends, Questlove and Common.
Yep.
Now we're going to find out about J Dilla and dive deep into his career.
That is going to be a great one, Greg. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor@soundopinions.org. That's sponsor@soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal, and our social media consultant, Katie Cott.